Hello. It's good to talk to you. We are almost back in the virtual conditions of the educational epidemic, but of course we're not really there. We're just having Confusion Tuesday. I hope you enjoyed the overture by way of The Great Hack, which we will talk about more in a moment. I feel oddly the appropriateness of our not being together in a room, but once again making bits for everyone to listen to, all in their different places at their different times, when we are in fact beginning to think about what it is that we mean by privacy and why, well, if you want to talk about law in the internet society, that's really the center of what you're talking about. But let's begin off-center by looking backward just a moment at what it is that we've been talking about over the last 3 weeks, not in its own intimate context, but in the larger meaning of this course. I have tried to show how the fundamental political economy of digital society is different than what established authority might want it to be. Established authority's theory of how the firm works and how the market works and how microeconomics ought to be taught in 101A is fine. There's nothing wrong with our understanding. It's that when we have an economy full of goods with zero marginal cost, and we like to think of ourselves as existing in a competitive market, then we should recognize that we have achieved a wonderful social result in which ignorance is unnecessary and every brain can learn everything it wants to learn without regard to the ability to pay. And that's such a horrible thought that we immediately begin shrinking from it and trying to figure out how to create absolutely non-competitive markets called monopolies through the government issuance of monopolies we call intellectual property and come to deify as the means of innovation. All of which is just, as I have spent 3 weeks trying to show, a bunch of crap. Digital society should make ignorance a thing of the human past, and it should make it possible for every brain on earth to learn, and that should result in the enormous social tumult and volatility unfavorable to established aristocratic orders that we called the Enlightenment once upon a time, and by which we really mean the herald of freedom of thought. But we have instead had an IP revolution followed by a freedom counter-revolution. And I have tried to show how that IP counter-revolution against IP, called freedom of thought, took on a new quality at the beginning of the digital age because it had in its favor the remorselessness of economic theory, and how we used that to change how software was made. By instituting propositions of sharing, which were superior to ownership-based proprietary production under new digital circumstances. That counter-revolution towards freedom, which created free software, also created other phenomena which resulted from the implosion of the idea of intellectual property, that is, state-created monopolies to prevent freedom of thought. The result of which was Wikipedia and Creative Commons and a whole lot of other matters we have been talking about, all of which were designed one way or another to capture the same fundamental point that free software captured. But free software was more than merely a theoretical proof of concept or some running code. Free software ultimately came to be two other things. A, how all the software in the world was made, because open source licensing and version control in distributed arrangements allowing programmers to work with complete coordination, in complete independence, completely without undesirable or unnecessary necessary hierarchy all happened, and the result was a profound alteration in the way technology occurs. But software is more than just a technology. Software is the physiology of the nervous system we are building around the human race that I have been discussing all these tedious weeks. And when we say that software is the physiology of the network, we therefore mean that the politics created by the network, how human society's distributions of power occur and how they dynamically interact with one another to secure either the rule of the many or the rule of the few, the politics that result from our networked society are the outcome of software. People now call it algorithms when they're talking about social media, by which they actually mean an analytics running on top of a stack of data warehousing and all the forms of relational database and web technology that free software built and now in the hands of those companies has been further reorganized into what we call the cloud, but which in the end, all of it is software, and every effect that it has on human society, whether large or small, whether it affects courtship practices or religious exercise or the use of arms and the fate of the state's monopoly of power, whatever is done with it, it is done in forms of software making that at least allow for, because they were created by us to allow for, the exercise of rights by users over the technology within which they live. Free software, then, is a machine tool, a tool for making machines, a tool for making the machines which are the physiological embodiments of the intentions that we have for the network that embraces us all, whether our intentions are to fulfill the democratic process, the promise of democracy, that every brain can learn and can govern its own development in individual and collective liberty, or whether the goal of the network is understood by those who operate it to be to stamp out the very idea of individual human rights and democracy completely. The two positions that are said at the moment explicitly to be occupied by the two largest and most powerful governments on Earth, whatever it is that the network is supposed to accomplish, it accomplishes it through software. And to the extent that users of that software, that is the people of the society, have rights in how that software works, then free software is the machine tool of the promise of the possibility that we can play a definitive role in making our own lives within the structure of the network. Not a small purpose, a small tool in exactly the right place at exactly the right time, transforming not only what we can do if we want to, but the way the businesses and governments of the world make software, because there isn't any other way to do it that is better, and they are drawn to the higher functioning that we allow for. Whether operating at the smallest level or the highest one, whether determining the way the laptop closest to your eyeball and your eardrum works, or determining the way the municipal software that runs your city works, or determining whether elections are conducted at all or whether it's a sham, all of that and everything else depends upon the way we make and use software, and to the extent that the very atom of the system, the software that runs all the computers that make up all the switches in the whole of the network that is the digital reflection of our society, to the extent that that tiny little structure, which is how we make and use the software legally, how we distribute it, how it's put together, and what the rules about it are, that's a place where you could get a lever to have its fulcrum. A tiny little spot, but if your lever had its fulcrum there, then if you could just stand back a while for a generation or so, you could move a lot of things, and we did. So I spent 3 weeks talking about that. And then, of course, we find ourselves at an institution that comes pretty much directly out of the free software world and the world of the West Coast cyberpunk anarchist technologists of my youth. A place I almost never got to be because it happens, the place does, at the beginning of what is in the academic world, the fall term, and I have spent all the fall terms of my adult life pretty much engaged in teaching somewhere. So Burning Man only happened ever in my head, pretty much. But there we are, at a moment which has all kinds of significance, if you want to think about the nature of human political possibility and what can be built and run in what kinds of ways and what can be taken apart again, if only you have the human itchy foot tendency to want to be doing one thing in September and another thing in April. But we're not here right now to talk about David Graeber's Dawn of Everything, although everybody in the world is going to be talking about it for a couple of weeks before they all forget about it again. We're talking about The Great Hack, which merely begins in Burning Man in the sort of James Bondery sense that Netflix documentaries have to begin someplace and have speedboats flying over turquoise Thai waters and so on. It's all very visual. But our relationship to The Great Hack is less about its visuals, though they are good, really good, than about its seeming inevitability. After all, you just watched a film about what is not the most recent Facebook outrage by two or three. And all the questions that seemed so conspiratorially complicated in 2019 about 2016... have become sort of taken for granted elements of the now we are on to something else. Is Instagram hurting people who are young women or late girls or, well, just vulnerable children? To which, of course, the answer is yes, like all the other answers have been yes before. This isn't the beginning of all of that either. When I said in the beginning of 2009 that Mark Zuckerberg had done more harm to the human race than anybody else his age, I was speaking historically. When I had a public spat on his own prestige television show with one of the initial funders of angel investors in Facebook in 2006 about whether this was a bad thing or not, about whether its effects on freedom were going to be a good thing or not, then maybe it was early days. I mean, you know, long before the IPO. But the thing that The Great Hack is teaching then isn't so much that if you have a mind to feel the threat of it, Facebook's always been a threat to the understanding of good order and the safety of the human race. Nor is it teaching that after the great expose and that, you know, moments of high legislative drama, that something's going to change. There's no Nick Clegg talking headshots in there because Mr. Clegg had yet to begin his serious post-deputy prime ministerial of the United Kingdom role as the, well, whatever Nick Clegg is now to Facebook, which is Meta by anybody's definition. What this is really telling us, of course, is that no matter how much high drama you try to spin up about it, the badness of Facebook has been known for the longest of times, and the badness of Facebook is not going to result in anything important happening unless you consider becoming Meta something happening, in which case you and he are pretty meta together. So why doesn't it matter that it's obvious that this is a toxic form of buildup in the human race resulting from a physiological malfunction, a pathology that is causing harm to the body, social, and to the psyche, individual, of vulnerable human beings? Why doesn't it matter that it's obvious? Now, to those of you who happen to have taken the first year course I teach called Law and Contemporary Society, you will know the answer to this question because we will have discussed together the first law of social psychology for lawyers, the single most important practical proposition in the psychology of the influence of minds upon minds for lawyers to know, and which accordingly is taught in my first year law school course, but never, as far as I am aware, in any other course in law school, namely, the first law of social psychology for lawyers, that you cannot make people see an invisible thing by showing it to them. You cannot make an invisible thing visible to people by showing it to them, because visibility or invisibility is not a property of the thing itself. Invisibility is a property of the perceiving mind, which has been conditioned one way or another not to see a thing, and therefore, when you show it to them, it still isn't there. The nature of Facebook's relationship to human social activity is not that uniquely bad. It is that Facebook's management, which is at all relevant times Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg, Facebook's leadership is bad. When a bad person has a business, the bad person's business is a bad business. But the fact that Facebook's business model is abuse, as I said in the third Snowden lecture in the fall of 2013, the fact that Facebook's business model is abuse, that it can't be corrected without ceasing to be itself, isn't the reason that the toxicity develops. The parasite with the mind of God, the structure we brought into existence made of software inside our network, isn't merely made of Facebook. Facebook is an organ in the pathology that is the parasite within us. The parasite is pathological entirely because we do not require it. Our network, the anatomy that we use for joining all of the human race together, does not require that simple services be offered to human beings for, quote, free, close quote, in return for comprehensive behavior collection of all of the individuals who use the services. There's nothing technologically required about that. We can have a network that performs all the functions that the network now performs, and many other really good ones that I use all the time and that nobody offers to you for free in return for comprehensive behavior collection, but we have a network full of comprehensive behavior collection which operates to destroy deliberative human freedom. The parasite has that effect. The way a parasitic wasp will change the behavior of the cockroach or gallworm or bee that it is infecting. The wasp's job is to modify insects in order to serve the parasitic need of providing a place for its young to be engendered. as the parasite with the mind of God needs human society to deliver human behavior to it, which it metabolizes, and in return for which it excretes hormones in the digital nervous system that stimulate more behavior. The parasite changes the way human thought works in order to benefit itself. Human beings like Mr. Zuckerberg in league with it are also benefited. What the great hack demonstrates is that no one will see, though everybody can visually acquire, that nobody can will recognize, even though everybody can testably perceive, that such a system within a short period of time begins also modifying the very nature of human government. It's not alone in that. When I said in the 20th century that what we then called totalitarianism there should better be known as monarchism with radio, and when we came to understand the effect of commercial television in creating what a chairman of the FCC famously called the vast wasteland of late 20th century American television, or when we think about all the ways in which the political economy of education is modified by the tablet computer, we recognize that the form of interaction between human beings and mass communications that precede our current smartphone-infested state were also destructive of some portions of what we wanted to have in order to make our societies equal and our politics responsive to human needs. But not on quite the scale with which human societies are presently engaged. This is why, whatever else we are thinking about when we are thinking about the role of law in digital society, we're going to be thinking about privacy. Privacy in whatever way we mean it, and we're going to have to come very close in understanding what we mean over the next several weeks. Privacy is the word which we use to designate some membrane between the still existing human individual and the increasingly existing human collectivity made and held together by the net, which is the new form of human society being born now in your lifetime. We should expect, therefore, that a word as important as privacy is also as indeterminate and capable of confusion as all such highly powerful words always are. This is the great work of genius that Raymond Williams called Keywords, his brief book attempting to show where the words are whose indeterminate complexities are the core, the shell, wrapped around all the difficulties we have in thinking about power and society. Privacy is a key word in our world, having both the characteristic of overwhelming importance and power and the equal characteristic of being hard to understand because confusingly indeterminate. So we will be thinking about privacy, and our most important initial task is to take apart what is held together in that bag, to analyze in the literal and specific sense this idea of privacy into components less indeterminate for which we can give precise definitions and about which we can think more precise thoughts. Privacy, then, I will say, like a particle made up of quarks, privacy contains three basic and interrelated concepts which together we unwieldily refer to by the portmanteau word. The components of privacy analytically are secrecy, anonymity, and autonomy. And each of those concepts we can define in a precise and technically coherent manner, so that when we have up, down, and charm in there working together to produce a neutron, we can understand a little bit more closely what that neutron really is. Secrecy can be defined as anonymity can be defined with respect to any message passing in the net, any burst from one neuron to another, every atomic activity in the network, the movement of a signal of some kind or another from point A to point B, down a pipe governed by a switch. Every message has either presence, the property of secrecy, or and the property of anonymity, or and no property of secrecy or anonymity at all. So let us think then about individual signals. We shall be spending a week each on the constituent parts, secrecy, anonymity, and autonomy. I don't intend to rush by any of this now while we are in this telephone booth of indeterminate shape and size together. We shall think about all these things again, but in the preview, so we can understand the large of what we are doing over the next several weeks, let us think about the precise technical definitions of secrecy and anonymity. A signal is secret if it can only be understood, comprehended, made effective for whatever the purpose of its message is. A signal is secret if it can only be read and understood by its intended recipient or recipients and its sender. If a signal is obscure to all parties not sending or intentionally receiving it, then it is secret. A signal is anonymous if, regardless of whether its content can be read and understood, its sender and recipients can be known to anybody other than they themselves. A signal is anonymous even if it is written on a postcard and delivered to the person whose name is on it, if its sender's name is obscure to everyone. A signal is anonymous if it can be seen by everybody because it is chalked on a wall, but nobody can discover who made it or who it is intended to be read by, save those people themselves. A signal may be both anonymous and secret. And as we shall see, for reasons related to the technology that underpins all contemporary digital society, a signal can be anonymous precisely to the same extent that it can be verifiably attributed to any particular human being, though they are inverse to one another. If a message cannot be attributed to any particular human being by anyone, then it is anonymous. And if recipients cannot be identified, that is, the transmission of the signal, its successful receipt cannot be attributed, then a signal, even if not secret, is covert. So, these two properties of a signal, that it is secret and that it is anonymous, can additively generate a secret anonymous signal, And as we shall see, the same technologies which provide us with secrecy and anonymity also provide us with verifiability and secure authentication of identity in the 20th century, in the 21st century. They travel together, and because they travel together, there are some interesting phenomena of their interrelationship that the law has to take into account. We shall see this when we talk about backdooring secrecy for the benefit of law enforcement, and why that ultimately means giving somebody the ability to forge an uncatchable passport or to sign your check. But for the moment, what we want to understand is that we can make secrecy and anonymity formal properties of messages. We can see, with respect to every signal passing through a nervous system that is our society or the whole of the human race put together, with respect to every signal that animates the entire anthill, at each line and trap in the whole process, we can attribute qualities, properties of secrecy or anonymity, or find them absent. We can measure scientifically and completely. The third property of privacy, the third object in the bag, the third quark in the particle, autonomy, is also precisely definable. But it takes us out of the sphere of information alone and puts us in the sphere of social life. Autonomy is the charm quark that gives us this presence in the current universe. Autonomy is defined as our ability, the human ability, not the ability of the signal or the data, the ability of the human beings who comprise society to make and effectuate their own life decisions without the influence of violations of their secrecy or anonymity. The ability to make and effectuate life decisions without influence resulting from violation of secrecy or anonymity is autonomy. We lose autonomy, in other words, when our activity is affected by failure of secrecy. When we can't keep secrets, we can't make choices. Not in the sense that every choice depends on secrecy and any violation of secrecy nullifies all our choices, but rather at the level of influence, of the way that we as individuals within society are directed, guided, nudged, pushed, coerced, blackmailed, compelled, or brainwashed. Because, of course, there's all the gradations in everything we do. We're never expressing only autonomy or only submission and subservience. But we are, we all are, constantly recreated on terms that are given to us by the social environment in which we find ourselves. We don't need to be living in the new digital society to be aware of the relationships between secrecy and anonymity and autonomy. Life in the city, life in the settlement too large for everybody to know who you are and for everybody to know everything you do. Life in the city has been different from life in the village for the last many thousand years. And in that difference between the comparative autonomy of the city and the comparative subservience to social role in the countryside or in the village rests a great deal of human pain and human art. So nothing I am saying here is distinctive to an analysis of privacy in the digital world, though secrecy and anonymity are technological properties of technological arrangements in the digital world. And nothing I am saying about autonomy escapes the understanding of those thinkers who have pondered the question of the nature of social privilege, freedom, and free will over the last, well, at least 1,500 years in various parts of the world. But just because it's visible doesn't mean that you can see it if it's shown to you. And so we have to struggle a little to understand how these fundamental properties of the ways that human beings interact, whether in a digital network or somewhere else, now operate. We need to understand, with relation to each of them, a slightly different historical and social proposition. With respect to secrecy, we can understand why governments are hostile to secrecy, always to some extent, and why in the course of the 20th century, government attitude towards changes in the balance of secrecy towards the citizen were particularly alarming. But we are not in the part of the course I teach next term, which is mostly about citizens and the state, about government and privacy. We are in a part which might be considered, in a way, posterior, what the private social powers that we call civil society, the market and commerce, do with respect to hostility to secrecy. But this, though it may seem posterior, first it is government that will decide how much secrecy to permit, actually turns out to be troublesomely wrong. For which reason we might as well have watched a 1986 movie, Minority Report, to have understood what Steven Spielberg understood in his research effort to prepare to make a movie of a Philip K. Dick science fiction work. Spielberg, as we shall see next week, I think without watching the movie, if you don't mind, but you can certainly watch it yourselves. I think Spielberg finds in the course of unearthing Minority Report from the collective consciousness, Spielberg finds a truth which, as we shall see, is deeply important. The private market in the destruction of human secrecy comes actually first. We may think of the state's hostility to secrecy as logically prior, but it's historically not. Secrecy, then, and the war on it comprised both a series of government actions at the end of the 20th century and a far more important set of private ones, related again precisely to the intellectual property implosion and the panic of the intellectual property owners. Anonymity, on the other hand, is a property we did not build into the anatomy of our network at the beginning, and which, therefore, we did not have so much occasion to lose as we had occasion never to gain fully. Assumptions about the relationship between identity and communication favorable to liberty, in favorem libertatis, were made by the architects of the net and by the generation of young people growing up within it at the very, very beginning, of whom I was one. But our assumptions in favorem libertatis weren't our engineering, and the network that we built was not supportive of the fundamental need for anonymity from the beginning. As we shall see, this was identified by the dark powers very early, and long before the end of the 20th century, we were being offered the opportunity to retain some aspects of secrecy in return for the long-term abandonment of anonymity to the powers favored by the state. It's an ugly story, but one that we haven't fully come to grips with yet, even as the Chinese Communist Party, in its rule of the People's Republic of China, does absolutely everything necessary to demonstrate to us how important it is that we learned the lessons of our last generation's history on this. But when we have, after the next 2 weeks, come to an understanding of the history and meaning of secrecy and anonymity in the internet society, and thought about its law in those connections just a little bit, we will have set the table to understand why our losses of autonomy, though we may find every single dirty little ball of it contained somewhere within the, dead thing, that meta thing that is Facebook, we shall see it everywhere else too. We shall understand why our autonomy is threatened not in one place or another, not subject to one breakup or one disvestment or one restructuring, let alone one renaming, new graphics, new demonstration of civilizational illegibility and incompetence. But something pervasive, something sitting, at the root of the nervous system that now joins us all, something parasitic, which must be excised if we, as we know ourselves, are to survive 2 generations more. Talk to you soon.